I said, the one thing you folks have never done is just say sorry. Apologize for the wrongs that you have done. I mean, they like to claim credit for uniting India. They ended up tarnishing it by actually dividing India when they left. It was a shameful, shameful Brexit.
Welcome, everybody. Today we have a very special guest in Moscow, author, historian, statesman. Now he's here with us, the formidable Dr. Shashi Tharoor.
Lovely to see so many of you here. I'm very glad to see you all here. The Indian-Russian relationship has been a special one. It's been unusually close for two countries, seemingly so far apart, with much less of a common history than one might otherwise have imagined. And yet, it has been a strong and close relationship. And that's why I'm so pleased to be with both Indian students in Russia, Russian students of India, and others here who've spent some time thinking about my country and yours, and I look forward so much to this conversation with you. Thank you all.
Many thanks, Dr. Tharoor. Now let's get the floor open for questions.
Great to see you in our city.
Thank you.
So I've been following you on YouTube for at least 8 years. So
ooh, yeah. Thank you. Glad to hear that.
So yeah, but that, I discovered your speech at Oxford, and it was really fascinating and was really interesting, kind of really provoking, I would say. So my question is the following. India recently landed on the moon. Its economy is on the rise. On the other hand, its former metropolis economy is in decline. Its population is suffering, and India is about to skyrocket soon. So the question is, when will time come to leave the pain of colonialism behind and look into the bright future with the with some pity towards former colonial power?
We're already doing that. Honestly, you know, I one of the reasons that I mentioned when my publisher said I should write this speech as a book was, I said, is it really necessary? Doesn't everybody know this? Can't we take it for granted and move on? And though I wrote the book and discovered that there was a lot that people needed to be reminded of, my message always, particularly when I was addressing young audiences, was, we must never forget, but we must forgive. Forgive, but don't forget is the message. As far as I'm concerned, I think none of us, and I'm a student of history, but I will tell you, none of us gains from living in the past. We have to focus on the present, on the future. And the present must be seen as a stepping stone to the future, not as an excuse to reinvent the past. The past is over. As far as I'm concerned, yes, the legacies of the past live on in the present. But we have, in the present, the capacity to overcome those legacies, provided, as you rightly said, our eyes are fixed towards the future. The most important thing for us is that we now deal with them as two sovereign, equal countries. And indeed, as you rightly said, our economy is now larger than theirs. So I think at this point, there is no risk of any inferiority complex. What's really important to India is that the Indian people should rise above the poverty they were left in when the British left us with 90% of our population below the poverty line, with 16% literacy in the country, with a life expectancy of 27, with world record figures of poverty, malnutrition, disease, infant mortality, maternal mortality, everything in the pits. And we have recovered from then, we've picked up the pieces, and today we are a very different country.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Stepan, a student of Moscow State University.
And are you a Russian or are you from somewhere else?
I'm Russian.
Great, nice to meet you.
The British Empire left India and Pakistan a conflict that has been going on for 80 years. Do you think it's possible to reach an agreement on the Indo-Pakistani conflict? And in which ways can this be done in the near future?
Well, you know, the conflict is unfortunate and totally unnecessary because there was a very clear understanding at the time of partition and independence in 1947 that the British provinces, directly ruled by the British, would be partitioned between the two countries, essentially following geography, and that the princely states, that is, the states ruled by hereditary Nawabs, Maharajas, rulers like that, they would get to choose where to join, but they should use their common sense and join the place that they were geographically closest to and part of. And by and large, for the most part, that worked out all right. There was one place, one princely state, which shared borders with both India and Pakistan, and that was the princely state of Jammu and Kashmir. And the Maharaja there initially dithered, didn't know which way to go. In the end, he chose India after he had been invaded by people who were called in those days language terrorists who had come from across the border. So he acceded to India. There have been a number of attempts made to find a solution. They've been talking to each other. It's not that there's been no talks. So it's not as if solutions cannot be identified. We don't want, frankly, any sort of war or conflict in our country. We've got far more important things to do. We're focused on the development of our country, on the growth and prosperity of our people. We're engaged in the great adventure of pulling millions of people out from below the poverty line. Progress has been made, particularly in the last 20 years or so, 25 years. We've seen some remarkable progress in India.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Sashi Taru.
Hi.
My name is Nikolai Balatsky, and I'm the student of the MSO, is my friend Stepan.
Mm-hmm.
So my questions, what should the West colonial countries treat its own legacy? And what does a true acknowledgement of brutality and theft look like in the eyes of India and the Global South? Thank you.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there are various ways to look at that question. And one way, as I mentioned in my remarks, is by doing accounts, as it were, for the damage done. I think that will lead us nowhere at the end of the day. Another is the return of stolen artifacts and so on. Some countries, you've seen after the Second World War, a lot of looted Jewish items that the Nazis had taken away from Jewish homes has now been returned to people. That's another way in which you can provide a certain kind of justice to victims. I mentioned too in my remarks, you can actually teach unvarnished history to your students. I discovered when I published my book that you could do the high school degree in England, the A-levels in history, without learning a word of colonial history. It's as if you could just airbrush that entire episode out of your past. You could have a museum, as I mentioned. And you could also definitely find ways of moral atonement. In some cases, for example, there are some very poor countries that could benefit from assistance from the colonial masters. And certainly there are countries in the Caribbean, for example, in Africa, which I think still deserve and require and need significant amounts of assistance to make up for what they underwent during colonialism. A country like India does not particularly seek financial aid. We'll grow our own economy. We don't need to seek that. But But there are other ways, and as I said, one simple way could simply be to say sorry as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Taru, thanks a lot. It's really, really a great honor to see you here.
Thank you.
But my question is, you also a prominent, one of the leading Indian political figures. I remember around 10 years ago watching this documentary, I don't know if you've seen it, called Muzaffarnagar Baki Hai. So this is about the UP politics and how what the current authorities in India managed to somehow shift reshape all the political landscape, making people shift from the way they voted before based on what the regional or linguistic or caste-based lines to, well, a sort of a religious lines, this communalism. So my question to you is, what do you think is happening with India in terms of its electoral system, and whether we're moving to a movie that should be called Bharat Baki Hai? Thank you.
Picture to abhi bahut baki hai. A lot left, because democracy is a process of evolution. And as you well know, democracy is a process, it is not an event. An election is an event. It takes place, it gives you a snapshot of people's views, preferences at a particular time. But then democracy has a wonderful way of changing that picture. The next time around, you get a different result. We have seen in India now, and that's one great strength of our democracy. Now, I would argue that there's more to democracy than the process of elections. Everything happens that happens between elections also matters. The quality of parliamentary debates, the degree of accountability of the elected representatives to the voters, the freedom of the press and other institutions to challenge those in power. All of these things are also important elements, and these are all in processes of evolution. And one good thing about democracy is that ultimately, when an elected government takes a decision, the public tends to go along with it, because they are, after all, the people who are elected. Whereas when you have sometimes different kinds of systems, you would always have a certain amount of discontent amongst those who've been left out. So all I can say right now is that I think we have a system that's lively, fierce, a lot of contention, a lot of debate, a lot of argument, a lot of disagreement. But ultimately, we are marching in the right direction.
My name is Sidorenko Yakov. I'm Moscow State University from. So my question is, countries may fight to end colonialism at a government level, but what about people? Will it take centuries of equality before it's defeated? And when can a country say it has thoroughly overcome the colonial mentality? Thank you.
You're right that one of the interesting aspects of colonialism is actually the colonization of the mind. Because as you say, the people were trained to think of their own cultures as inferior, their own people as inferior, and the colonialists are somehow representative of all that was good and noble and fine and developed in the world. And this, I'm afraid, we've seen in many, many parts of the world. India was a little fortunate in that we had some people who were interested in sort of Indology for its own sake, and who helped revive, translate, and protect and preserve some of these texts. But it is really only after independence that Indians have fully realized the magnitude of what they themselves have in their own culture and their own heritage, and have revived everything from Indian classical dance, which had been neglected and banished and sidelined, to Indian classical music, to, of course, a consciousness of ancient sciences, ancient practices, including medical practice like Ayurveda, science of wellness like yoga. All of these things have really been given a new revival in India today in the post-colonial era. And that's something that's extremely important and that colonialism took away from others.
Myself, Raja Maurya. I am from Pondicherry, India.
Okay, hi, Raja.
Currently, I am pursuing my master's in global order, challenges and transformation. political science in Moscow State University. And my research topic is India's emerging order, yep. strategical anatomy of India in BRICS, Quad and SEO. My question is that history always repeats. First World War, they created League of Nations in Geneva. After Second World War, they created United Nations in New York. After this kind of, there will be a new world order where India will be the new headquarters to balance between them, because India started from a non-alignment to multi-alignment. Will India have a new strategic idea to balance between the East and West and be a neutral state to make a new global order headquarters?
Right. No, I wouldn't say history always repeats itself. History will repeat itself if you don't learn from it. I think we've all had to learn. The United Nations in many ways reflects what has been learned about the failures of the League of Nations. And we've seen some of the strengths and the weaknesses of the United Nations as it exists today. Certainly India, as you know, has been advocating reform of the Security Council for some time because it's no longer as representative a body as it ought to be. It reflects the geopolitical realities of 1945 much more than that of 2025. But that's another topic. When you talk about India, yes, strategic autonomy or sovereign autonomy, whatever you want to call that, has been fundamental to our approach to the world. And the reason for that is indeed colonialism. And for 200 years, somebody else has been deciding what you're supposed to stand for in the world. Somebody else has been speaking for you in the world. Somebody else has been representing you in the world. The last thing you want to do is to surrender, as an independent nation, your rights to have your own view to anybody else, which is why India was very reluctant. Not reluctant, it was actually refused to join any alliance, because when you join an alliance, somebody else decides for you what your stand is going to be. And India said, no, we've had 200 years of that, now we decide. There's a joke which may or may not be true about how President Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, allegedly said to India's first Prime Minister Nehru, "Are you with us or against us?" And Nehru answered, "Yes." In other words, I'm with you when I agree with you, I'm against you when I disagree with you, and I will decide depending on the issue. That was the essence of non-alignment. Today, the world is no longer divided in a binary division between two big superpowers. In those days, the US and the Soviet Union, and you had to work out a passage between, which was called non-alignment. Today, the world is much more complex. And in this much more complex world, you have something similar to the World Wide Web, the Internet. We're connected in different ways. Just as in the Internet, I might be connected to you for some purpose or the other. You might be connected to her, but I may not be connected to her. So you have different connections for different purposes. I'll give you a couple of examples. India, the Indian foreign minister meets his Russian and Chinese counterparts every year in something called RIC. Then they had the Brazilians and the South Africans in BRICS. Now, of course, BRICS is 11, but I'm talking about the original BRICS. Then they take out the Russians, but they keep the Chinese, and they have something called BASIC as a grouping for environmental negotiations. Okay? Then they take out both the Russians and the Chinese, and they have IBSA for South-South cooperation, India, Brazil, and South Africa. Now, all of these configurations are different ways of aligning your interests. And I often joke that India is the only one present in all of these, and not merely because its name begins with a very convenient thing, a vowel. So you can pronounce IBSA and BRICS and BASIC and so on because you have a vowel there. But also because each of these formulae has some value to India, and because India has something valuable to contribute to each of them. That is how the concept of multi-alignment has arisen. We connect for different purposes with different countries. We try not to make any permanent alliances. We keep our own autonomy, our own strategic autonomy to decide what is best for us in a particular context. But we also decide who we want to align with on a particular issue. So we may agree with one set of countries on one particular problem and a different set of countries on a different problem. And that, it seems to me, is one way of seeing your way forward in the world.
Dr. Kharoor, thank you for covering the questions in such a deep way. I am a student of Moscow State Institute of International Relations, and it seems that today we are covering mostly India-West relations, but I'd like to slightly change the direction and ask you, what's your take on the relation of the two rising powers in Asia, such as China and India? Do you think that their confrontation is going to change landscape of international arena in the foreseeable future?
I certainly hope not, but the fact is that there has been a decline in the quality of the relationship in recent years. India and China have been two giant Asian civilizations for a very long time and have had, in the ancient history, very close and friendly relations. In fact, Buddhism went to China from India. Chinese scholars used to come and study in Indian universities going back 2,000 years. There are records of all of this. But in recent times, there has been disagreements, first of all, over territory. The Chinese have still not settled the long border with India, which is the world's longest unresolved frontier dispute. On top of that, we have a strategic problem in our neighborhood, which is that China is a very strong backer of Pakistan. And you must understand that as far as China is concerned, they have a big stake in Pakistan. The single biggest project under their Belt and Road Initiative is the project called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which runs through Pakistan, indeed partially through territory that Pakistan took illegally from India in 47-48. The territorial dispute resulted in a very unprovoked and unnecessary confrontation in 2020, in which 20 Indian soldiers were killed. And a smaller but unknown number of Chinese. I think it was most unfortunate, but as a result of that, there was a deep freeze in the relationship. There was no normal friendship between India and China for some years. A thaw began late last year in September of 2024, September, October. At that time, there was the beginning of normalization. Slowly, carefully, the two countries were talking to each other. Some cooperation was coming. And then we ended up with this recent conflict with Pakistan, where once again China took a certain view that we were not terribly happy with in Delhi. But nonetheless, we've got elements there that could work for a modus vivendi. I think the first thing to do would be if the Chinese would also make a real effort to settle the border. Their current position is, let's leave it for later generations. But as long as it remains an unsolved issue, it becomes a continuing irritant between our two countries. So all of these reasons, I think, would require serious effort for peace, and we have not yet seen much serious effort coming from that side.
Mr. Sharoor, thank you. Considering your experience at the United Nations, what do you think are the possible solution to the Iran-Israel conflict? And one more. How do you think peace can be achieved in the Middle East?
Oh, boy. Well, on Iran-Israel, it looks like we suddenly have a solution, which is quite remarkable given the way it came about, because you had the U.S. bombing Iran, you had a retaliation by Iran against the U.S. air base, and the next day you had an announcement of peace. So it was quite an extraordinary event in recent world history. But having said that, the issue at stake appears to be the question of nuclear development. And I think there, India has consistently had a view that the best solution to this kind of nuclear problem is universal nuclear disarmament. Now, I know that Russia won't like that, and America won't like that, and the Brits and the French, they all want to hold on to their nukes. But this is the problem. As long as some have nuclear weapons, others will always want to try and have them on the grounds that that's what will protect them. And the motivation to have them will increase. Whereas if these weapons were universally outlawed and everyone gave them up, as India proposed at the United Nations way back in the 1980s, so that kind of solution is what we have to struggle for.
One last question. Dr. Tharoor, do you want to pick and choose?
Well, let's go for a lady in that case. Is there one right here? Front row?
The lady in pink it is.
Hello. First, let me introduce myself. My name is Daria. I'm a student of Moscow State Institute of International Relations, mm-hmm. Master's Program, International Security. And my question is about future. And you have already mentioned some of India's achievements in space exploration, and we admire and respect them. I read a lot of articles about them. But unfortunately, there is another aspect that has to do with arms control and arms race that is about to start and to take place in space sphere. And my question is on India's view, on your perspective, how can we prevent it? How can we deal with militarization and how can we prevent weaponization of space? Thank you very much.
Very good question, to which I wish I had more authority to answer. I'm not an expert on this, but you're 100% right. Space is a common legacy for all of humankind. It should not be something that gets militarized, where one strong power tries to use space or parts of space against someone else and so on. I think there has been some discussion in the United Nations context about treaties on outer space. And I think that very clearly, in principle, everyone agrees that one should not be militarizing outer space. But you're totally right that controlling arms in space is going to be perhaps the next big challenge we'll have to worry about. I just hope we never start that space arms race, because once it starts, it gets much more difficult to control. If no one does anything, then we should try and create an agreement before anyone starts this dangerous process. Thank you for raising that question.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody, for your questions, and thank you, Dr. Tharoor, for your answers and for your very precious time. But please stay tuned for Dr. Shashi Tharoor's show on RT. It will be on air sometime very soon.
Thank you very much, and it was really a pleasure. I apologize to all those whose hands were still up, but I still have one more engagement to get to in Moscow, and I have an early morning departure tomorrow. So we will have to end this, but thank you so much for your presence, your attention, your questions, and your interest. I appreciate it very much. All the best. Thank you.